Hello, and welcome to episode 60 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We are here today with Vinnie DeMarco, president of Maryland Citizens Health Initiative. How are you doing today, Vinnie?
Great. Thanks for having me on here. Thank you.
Glad to have you. The first question I'd like to ask is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Hello?
Yeah, the first thing you've ever done to advance the public interest and why?
Well, years ago, I got actively involved in public health and public safety issues, primarily on gun violence prevention. I was motivated as a young man, young boy, by the horrible deaths of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. And in the 1980s, I got the chance to work in Maryland on with a broad coalition to advance gun violence prevention. We had one of the most important successes in the whole country when we defeated the gun lobby for the first time ever on a ballot initiative. And since then, I've had the pleasure of working on gun violence prevention, reducing teen smoking and underage drinking, expanding health care in Maryland and across the country. And it's been really, really rewarding. I greatly enjoy working on these public health issues.
So many individuals were alive in 1968 when Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were killed, but not as many individuals proceeded to take action to actually that resulted in real legislative change and greater regulation of firearms in a particular state. How is it? Could you describe a little bit the path that you took from being inspired in the late 60s by tragic events to actually seeing real legislation be passed in the state of Maryland?
Well, I was 11 years old when those horrible tragedies happened, and it just stuck with me. And subsequently, I went to college and law school and graduate school and always had it in my head to get involved in public interest. And in the late 1980s, I was at the honor of working for Attorney General Steve Sachs in Maryland Attorney General's office. And at the time, there was this incredible opportunity came up because the highest court in Maryland ruled that anybody who was shot by a Saturday Night Special handgun, one of these cheap handguns are only really useful for criminals, can sue the manufacturer of it. And there was an attempt by the gun lobby to override that in the legislature. So a group of us formed a coalition to defend that court decision. And out of that coalition came one of the first bans in the country on these Saturday Night Special handguns. And then the gun lobby took it to referendum in 1988. And this was a formative event for me because we had to defeat the gun lobby that was spending $6 or $7 million, which in 1988 was a lot of money, and we only had a few hundred thousand, but we defeated them. And it showed the power of coalitions and the power of faith community and other groups coming together against powerful vested interests to save lives. And out of that victory came the subsequent the subsequent advances in Maryland leading up to the 2013 passage of the Firearm Safety Act, which requires anybody who gets a handgun has to first be licensed by the state police. So really, it was that opportunity that came up in the 1980s with that court decision and my being prepared from my education and my background working in organizations like Young Democrats and other organizing organizations to take advantage of that. And after that, I got involved in other issues also like public health.
Okay. So well, just to clarify what we were speaking about, so the gun lobby in the 1980s spent $6 or $7 million on a campaign to influence public opinion in a public referendum on Saturday Night Special handguns?
Yeah, it was 1988. We got passed a landmark law during the session to ban Saturday Night Special handguns, and the gun lobby took it, put it on the ballot, took it to referendum, And it was a dramatic victory for us that really made a lot of national headlines and resulted, I think changed the national equation a little bit, because it proved that the gun lobby could be defeated, and I think helped to spur the national debate that led to the Brady Law and the assault weapons ban nationally. So it was very, very important.
Was that the first time that the gun lobby had been beaten in a highly visible way in this nation?
It's the first time, as I understand, it's the first time they've been beaten on the ballot in a referendum like that.
Interesting.
So it's historic. Yeah.
So you were able to have success in a public referendum, and you managed to turn that movement, that grassroots organization that you built, into, I think, multiple nonprofit organizations that you've been the leader of. Can you talk about that transition and how, as you mentioned, your advocacy for tighter firearm regulation led to greater involvement in public health initiatives across the board?
Well, I learned in 1988 just the power of coalitions, groups like the NAACP and faith leaders and community groups, and how if they really come together, they can take on and defeat even the most powerful vested interests. And I built that into what we've call a six-step process for moving public health issues. That includes first coming up with a smart evidence-based solution to your problem, doing polling to test public opinion, building a strong coalition, using the media extensively to get your message out, making the issue an election issue, and then going to the legislature to get it passed. And we used these six steps in 1994 to build for even more gun violence prevention success in a one gun a month law, banning assault weapons in Maryland, assault pistols in Maryland. It was very, very productive. And then people reached out to me who were working on the tobacco issue. And I had also been influenced on tobacco because a dear uncle of mine died way too early because he smoked. And it was really devastating to his brother, my father, and devastating to me. So I saw in the late 90s how the tobacco companies were really exploiting kids. And it's probably way before your time, Jordan, but they used something called Joe Camel, which was this ad that really directly went to kids. It became more popular even than Mickey Mouse. It was so ubiquitous. And the teen smoking rate was through the roof. And the public health experts all said that the best way to address that is increasing the cigarette tax. but like on the gun issue, it was very, very difficult to enact cigarette tax increases because of the power of the tobacco lobby. And so in 1997 to 99, we created an organization called the Maryland Children's Initiative, whose goal was to increase the cigarette tax. And we used that same six-step process, which was so effective on the gun issue, to enact one of the country's first major cigarette tax increases in 1999. And that caused a dramatic drop in smoking in Maryland. And we even had to overcome a filibuster by the other side, which was not easy, but we did it. And that led to two other cigarette tax increases in Maryland, a result of which Maryland has had a 30% drop in smoking, 40% amongst young people, double the national average, resulting in over 200,000 people not smoking who would have smoked, and Jordan, had 70,000 people who would have died, preventable deaths like my uncle did not die, those kind of deaths.
So you found that. So you spoke about increasing a tobacco tax and that it was actually efficacious in reducing the incidence of new smokers and reducing the incidence of smoking-related disease. So it actually saved lives. And are you saying that it also saved dollars?
It saved dollars because the state had less costs from the health care coverage of people with tobacco-caused illness. And it brought dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, which Maryland used to expand health care to hundreds of thousands of people even before the Affordable Care Act. So that was a tremendous success. And from that, we created the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative, which since 1999 has been working to achieve quality, affordable health care for all Marylanders. And it's just been a great honor and privilege for me to be working on all of these issues, including implementing the Affordable Care Act in Maryland, which has reduced the uninsured rate in half and provide health care to over 400,000 people. And in 2011, we increased for the first time in 40 years the alcohol tax in Maryland. And that also has been very important in reducing underage drinking, drunk driving, and other problems caused by alcohol, and bringing in money, which has been used to help people with developmental disabilities, mental health issues, et cetera. So the public health successes in Maryland have been tremendous, and the process by which we accomplished them is what I learned in the late 80s, early 90s, working on the gun issue.
Mm-hmm. So, well, and just bringing it back very quickly to the gun issue, you've mentioned that you've been effective at using taxes to reduce alcohol-related illness and death, and also you said for smoking-related illness and death. Sometimes you have opponents of firearm regulation saying that what really needs to be done is enforce the current laws, and just because you abolish assault rifles, you're not actually reducing death, because most of the firearm-related accidents or death homicides are due to legally held guns. Can you talk a little bit about whether and how the passage of firearm regulation bills in Maryland actually led to a decrease in firearm-related injuries and fatalities?
Well, there were studies by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health on both the Saturday night special ban that we enacted in 1988 and mm-hmm. the 1994 ban on assault pistols, and both those studies found that it resulted in a drop in use of those kind of guns in crime and drop in death rates. But the most important thing we enacted in Maryland on the gun issue was in 2013, requiring mm-hmm. that anybody who wants to get a license, a handgun, has to first be licensed by the police and be fingerprinted. And the studies from other states that have had those laws are dramatic. In Connecticut, after they enacted such a law, there was a 40% drop in gun deaths. And when they mm-hmm. repealed such a law in Missouri, there was a 25% increase in gun deaths. And we're already seeing in Maryland mm-hmm. more of the guns used in crime coming from out of state rather than in state, which is the first sign that this law is working. So the evidence is clear that these public health measures work, both handgun purchaser licensing, tobacco taxes, alcohol taxes. The problem is overcoming these powerful vested interests, and that's what our process has helped to accomplish.
So, and I'd like to talk a little bit about about the process that you've developed, the six-step process.
Yeah.
And how exactly you are able to mobilize such diverse constituencies as African American churches and the Catholic Church and which they could be the same, and barber shops and all kinds of different places that you have pulled individuals from to build these coalitions. Can you talk a little bit about the six-step process, and maybe we'll walk through some of those steps together?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and in fact, just the last few days, I've been lecturing about the six-step process at the University of Maryland School of Social Work and Johns mm-hmm. Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health to students who want to learn advocacy, and really, if you think about the six steps, they are reasonable ways to transform public will into political power. So if you have the public really want something like handgun purchaser licensing or tobacco taxes, but there's a powerful vested interest opponent, you need these six steps to overcome those opponents and mobilize the support. And step one is important because you need to have evidence-based solutions. So before we went forward with any of our proposals, we asked experts at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health or elsewhere, What evidence supports policies that would deal with these problems? And they gave us reports.
So let me interrupt you real quick. Before you even get to step one, you mentioned a pre-step, which was you want to make sure that the public supports this thing. Now, I know you said that polling was the second step. But when you're identifying a problem, you think public has support. Like maybe the public thinks that there's too much smoking going on, but I'm not sure how many people were walking around saying, well, gosh, what we really need is a cigarette tax. How do you identify what the public really wants, and then how do you identify what the public really wants, and do you ever say, like, well, this is something I think they'd want, and you try to convince them of that's really a problem and that they need your solution?
Well, these are good questions. Once we have learned from experts that there's a solution out there that would really work, we do some intensive polling, public interest polling, and the pollster we use in Maryland usually is OpinionWorks, one of the best polling companies here. And what we ask is, first of all, do you support whatever our proposed solution is, the dollar increase in cigarette tax or hang-up-pressure licensing, alcohol tax? And we usually find broad support. But then we ask a series of three questions to really drill down and see how strong the support is. We ask, in the next legislative election, who are you going to vote for legislature, a Democrat or Republican? Just a generic question. And every time, the Democrats up by about 20 points because we're a typically blue state. But then we ask, what if the Democrat supports X, either one of these proposals, and a Republican opposes it? Well, then we have found tremendous increase in support for the Democrat and drop in support for the Republican. But then we ask, what if the Republican supports it and the Democrat opposes it, and a reverse happens and support moves toward the Republican, sometimes ahead? And by doing that, we see that there's strong public will. We need to mobilize it, but there's strong public will. If we had done the poll and had not found that, we could not have done these six steps. And in that case, what we would have to have done was to, as you're saying, educate the public on how important it is to increase cigarette tax. But on the issues I've worked on, the public already knows. You've got to increase cigarette tax, reduce teen smoking, and these other measures. So that's what step two does. Step three is how I'm sorry.
Yeah, just before we get to step three, I'd like to ask, so with all this polling, have you ever had an issue where you found that the public wasn't already behind it? And then could you talk a little bit about how you pivoted and launched that educational campaign before you could proceed to step three?
I have not. I know others have, but I have not. The issues
that
I've worked on.
You've never abandoned an issue then?
No. The issues I've worked on, there's always been very strong public support. Now, none of them have been easy because the opposition has always been very tough and very powerful and lots of money and lots of clout. But the public has always been there on the issues I've worked on.
Okay. So, all right. So you do the polling and you figure out, you confirm that this is an issue that you could potentially win. And that really seems to be what the point of the poll is, correct?
Yes. The point of the poll is twofold. One is to show us that there is the public will out there. And remember, don't just poll to see is there support for X proposal, but really drill down like we did to see if people would actually make voting decisions based on it.
And do you ever change your strategy based on poll results?
Well, not the overall strategy, but we sometimes can adjust our message based on what we learn from polling on how people see the issue. But our overall strategy has always been reinforced by this polling. And the other thing polling does, you release it and it influences people.
And then, let's just quickly run through 3 through 6. Just bang them out right here.
3 is you write a resolution to get organizations to sign, as many as possible, including faith groups and everybody else. You build a broad coalition. 4 is you use the media to the hilt. Really do a lot of earned media, paid media when you can, and, of course, social media to get the message out broadly. Press conferences whenever major groups endorse your proposal. Get editorials, op-eds, really use the media. And 5 is to turn the resolution into a candidate's resolution and send it to all the candidates running for office, so that get them to endorse it, And candidates running for office are very sensitive to when their constituents or the people that, whose vote they're trying to get are demanding that they sign something, they might do it. And we build a lot of support that way. And then six is you go to the legislature to get something passed. And Jordan, I've talked around the country about this, and one of the mistakes that advocates make so often is they go to step one, two, and maybe a little bit of three, and then go right to six, and that's not enough to overcome powerful vested interest opposition. And if people want to learn more about this, there is a book written about this process called The DeMarco Factor, Transforming Public Will into Political Power. It's by Michael Perchik, who was President Carter's FTC chair and an advocacy guru. You can find it on Amazon.com, DeMarco Factor, Transforming Public Will into Political Power, and it really describes this technique in detail.
Excellent. And we'll hyperlink to that on the actual podcast.
Great.
So it sounds like a lot of people, advocates, generally overlook the media advocacy. They don't put enough effort into the coalition building, which was step three, the media advocacy step four, and then step five, which is make sure that all the candidates sign on to it and you kind of pressure them and promote them and their campaigns.
Yes.
And then they just try to jump right into getting the thing passed.
Right.
Without that public pressure and the political pressure that you've generated, there's not enough momentum oftentimes to get the thing through.
You've summarized it extremely well. And there's a chart I'm going to send you that summarizes the six steps that you can share with people.
All right, excellent. So now that we're approaching the end of the podcast, I'd like to ask you a final question, which is to reflect on your decades of public service in so many ways, right? You've hit on firearm regulation. You've done public health, which encompasses most of what you've done is within public health. You've done firearm regulation, tobacco regulation, alcohol regulation. You've used taxes as a disincentive for deleterious behavior. And you've created organizations, you've created movements. Why have you done all this? What's your motivation? Is this exciting to you? Is it interesting? Is it something that gets you, what gets you going every morning? Is it, do you like having a positive influence? What are your general motivating factors? What really drives you and motivates you to do what you do every day?
Well, I just feel deeply, deeply gratified when I see the results of thousands of people's lives being saved and not having to go through the horrible death that my uncle went through because of tobacco and knowing that there are less drunk driver deaths because of the alcohol tax. That's deeply rewarding to me. And Jordan, I love it. I love the coalition work, working with people like you and others across the state and across the country. So for those two reasons, I love getting up every morning and going to work knowing that I'm working to save lives and make lives better and just loving the interaction with great people all across the country.
So you see with Vinnie DeMarco a story that's both unique and similar to others in public service, where originally inspired by national events, that's also inspired by personal anecdotes and experiences with tragedy, goes on and finds a particular issue area and has success, and that grows and develops and allows him to develop an interest in public health advocacy that he couldn't even have foreseen. And just being able to make one step and focus on an initial problem and having a small victory or a large victory in the very beginning allows you to have such greater impact throughout the course of his life. So Vinnie DeMarco is an advocate who is excited about what he does and is having a national impact as he advances issues that he thinks advances the public health interest, the public interest within the realm of public health. So this has been episode 60 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Thank you so much for joining us, Vinny.
Thank you so much. I love your show. Thank you.
Thank you, and we will talk to you next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.